stage. Everybody in this class brings a different background, which is great. There's no question that isn't the right question. I'm easy to find. My email should be on the syllabus, I think. If not, it's somewhere around. No? I didn't put it on there? Okay, so it's easy if you want to write down. It's just neilrubin@comcast.net. So not hard to remember at all. Yeah, it was Leah Ari, my kids. I still have that one, but I just figured it would be easier for people to... Everybody kept saying Leah Harry, you know? And I'm like, it's Leah Ari. Actually, what I'd like to do, we just went around and said something about ourselves. I'm going to have us go around a few more times. To your detriment, I've learned how to be more interactive as a teacher. So, and you can pass if you want to. I'm not going to make everybody speak. I'm going to start with Myra on this end this time. And tell me one or two things that you'd like to get out of this class this year and or questions that you might have.
Well, first of all, I'd like to know what your name is.
Neil, N-E-I-L, Rubin, R-U-B-I-N. Okay. And my email is neilrubin@comcast.net. And I used to be the editor of the Jewish Times, so some of you know me in that context as well.
Yes, that sounds familiar. What I expect to get out of this class? I think you're planning to teach the history of the creation of Israel and Zionism, and that's what I came to get.
Terrific. Marshall?
Well, I'd like to be able to put a lot of things that I know in perspective and put them in a stream that makes sense rather than a little of this and a little of that.
Terrific.
And learn, obviously, a lot of other things.
Good.
Same thing, only I want a timeline.
Timeline, okay. Keep that in mind. So if I'm not specific on certain things with dates, you let me know and I'll get that.
I will.
Okay.
I think I'd like to know what's happening today based on what's been going on for 60 years.
Context of the headlines. Okay, good.
I think that's right.
Terrific.
Along similar lines, how Zionism is the opinion of Zionism in general has changed in the world community.
Okay.
And within the state of Israel.
Okay, and we'll definitely be getting that, particularly in the later. We're going to lay a lot more history, and then we're going to get to kind of the last three lectures, basically, are devoted to the headlines of today in different ways. You know, the Arabs, is land for peace still viable? You know, what does it mean to be a Jewish state? That type of stuff. But we're going to do a lot of work before we get there.
I want to refresh myself from what I already know. I want to fill in some cracks, and I'm interested in finding out what I don't.
Terrific.
I can only ditto everything that's gone before.
Okay.
She used my line. Ditto.
I am looking at this as part of my continuing personal struggle to determine whether coexistence is feasible with the Palestinians in a way that meets the reasonable aspirations of both Jews and Arabs.
And in section 19, we are going to explore everything that's been put forward so far, way back till, I guess, 1937, and then really 39, the St. James Palace Conference, to refresh your memory on that. And we will look at whether or not that's still viable today and what are the options available, including the option of stalemate, which sometimes is a viable option, right? It's often been said some problems don't have solutions, you have to manage them. And we'll look at the pros and cons of that as well. Yeah?
I would say most of what's been said around the table.
Okay.
I'd like to be able to understand better what led us to where we are today.
Terrific. And you guys want to?
Not much. I just would like to be able to predict the future of
Israel. Right. You actually would be better off predicting the future of the stock market.
But I will say, as a tag one, I'd like to know and be able to feel understand maybe about the coexistence of the Orthodox and non-Orthodox communities.
We'll definitely talk about that. I'll give you a preview, by the way, one statistic that we'll look more into as we go down the road. I think it's by the year 2020, it might be 2025, 50% of the first graders in Israel will be Arab for ultra-Orthodox Haredi, which means 50% will be non-Zionist. Profound implications for the future. And by the way, you see elements of that in this community when you compare it to what it was 30 and 40 years ago. Yeah.
Looking around the room, we're of a different generation than the young mm-hmm. adults today. And there's a totally different perspective in terms of Israel and the challenges and, frankly, even the viability or the raison d'etre for a Jewish state. And it's not just among the non-Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It's among the Jews as well. And hopefully we'll get some clarity, or at least I'll mm-hmm. get some clarity in terms of responding to some of these issues.
Sure. And, you know, some generations were forged. Their identity and relationship to Israel was forged in 48 or 67 and 73. I was in college during the Lebanon War. That had a profound impact on me. Others, various intifadas, and so on. And it all has a real impact on how you view these things. And it's good we have a multi-generational room. We're going to bring in some really good perspectives. All right, now I'd like to ask you to do one thing. If you have a piece of paper, you can write this down. If not, just think about it. I want you to write your definition of Zionism in one word. Take 30 seconds for that. One word. I have to time my students for everything, or else they won't do it. And I'll be looking around, seeing if you're done writing, put your pen down, and then I'll know. Seconds. Yeah, that's what you do, though. I shall fall asleep. All right. Anybody still working on it? How about some answers? Any volunteers? One word.
Identity.
Identity. Good one.
Return.
Return.
Loyalty.
Eretz Yisrael.
It's two, but we'll let you slide. We'll let you slide. Did you say that in English or Hebrew?
The land.
Okay, the land.
Homeland.
Okay. Anyone else?
I thought my workshop response to that was freedom.
Freedom. That's one of the ones I thought of. I also thought of the word destiny. All right? It depends on how you want to look at it. I thought of the word destiny. Now, think about what Zionism means in one sentence. You don't have to use your word, but you certainly can. I see a couple of people writing, so we'll take a few more seconds. All right, who would like to share? Mitch.
The realization of a Jewish national homeland in the land of Israel.
That sounds like it was taken from the Declaration of Independence.
I'd like to think that it's a place to go where you're the majority.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else want to share out?
Say the return of Jews to their destiny.
The return of Jews to their destiny. Very nice.
Rebirth of the Jewish nation.
The rebirth of the Jewish nation. Anyone else want to? Yeah.
The right to live in Israel and be a Jew.
The right to live in Israel and be a Jew. Is someone else?
Israel is a safe haven for Jews.
Safe haven for Jews, and that's very interesting because. For your generation, and I'm not trying to stereotype you, it was a time in the world when Jews couldn't go anywhere else, and they had to go to the land of Israel because it was the only place that would take them, and there were Jewish communities in stress, in strife, in distress is the word I'm looking for, all over the world. Do you know today, there literally, to the best of our knowledge, is no major Jewish community in distress in the world, and that is the first time in history. that has basically happened, which means...
In what way? Are you
well, when you were in the Soviet Union, if you openly were Jewish, you could have been thrown in jail or worse. Okay. When you were in Ethiopia and so on, when you were in Iraq and so on.
In France, you're not in jeopardy? I mean, in a lot of European countries.
Yes, there's stress there, but it's not existential. It's, I shouldn't say existential. It's nowhere near what was happening in past times.
Well, if you don't know relativity, I mean, you may be right, but I mean, if you're a Jew in France today...
Yeah, but it's not state-supported.
It's right. That's the other thing, too. The state mechanism, the state apparatus isn't against it.
We said stress. We didn't say it was necessarily state-related.
Fair enough. Nothing compared to what was,
plus,
Mitch.
The 20 Arab countries, there are very, very few Jews.
The only one that has a sizable Jewish community is Morocco. It's roughly 15,000. And they have official protection by, I think it's King Hassan IV.
Right.
I think he's the fourth. And in fact, the Jews even put up a statue to King Hassan III in Rabat.
The politics.
Absolutely. So anyway...
Hassan's Jewish doctors.
Right. And Maimonides was the doctor to the Sultan in Cairo, right?
And the Jews are to the Hamas guy, their daughter. His daughter's in Israel.
Oh, right. Yeah, the doctors were helping her out. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I read that actually in the Jerusalem Post. Actually, let me get this back up. So, all of what you said is correct. And what we're leading up to by the end of this course is the fact that now we need to figure out what being a Jew in the 21st century means with Israel as a quote-unquote normal state, whatever that means, meaning our relationship to it is not just one of, that's where we send Jews who are running for their lives. That's where we send Jews who are running for their lives. But the first thing we have to do when we look at Zionism is put it in the context of its time. We're talking about something that arose in the late 18th and 19th century. We had the horrible book by Hobsbawm last year on nationalism, which we all suffered through, which gave us some context and background on that. Rival movements were fighting for the hearts and souls of the Jewish people at this time. Zionism was not the only option. You know, today, Zionism is pretty much the only thing that's pulling at us as Jews. But back then, there was something called autonomism, which was something that was promulgated by Simon or Shimon Dubnov, who was a great historian. He said that Jews, particularly, let's say, in the Pale of Settlement or in Galicia, should have an autonomous homeland just like any other people would, and they would send representatives to the parliaments. It would be the Jewish home, basically, because that's where Jews were living. There was something called territorialism. Does anyone remember that? Anyone remember territorialism? That was a movement to settle Jews anywhere. There were even Jews, there were 9,000 Jews that came into this country through Israel Zangwill's territorialist organization through the port of Galveston, Texas. There are Jewish families in Texas today that can trace their lineage to that. There were Jewish colonies that were set up in Argentina, and they looked at a whole bunch of other places. They were originally part of the Zionist movement, but they broke off. Socialists, hardcore socialists, particularly the Bund in Poland. All right, here's a demonstration by the Bund in Poland. It's hard to make out, but that's Yiddish writing up there. I believe, in secular messianism, which was distribution of wealth, everybody's equal, everybody's in harmony. It's a messianic vision. It's a messianic vision. Communism. One of my favorite ironies in Jewish history is that Stalin set up a section called Yevseksia. Yevseksia was the department in the new Soviet government starting in 1919, which aimed to convert the Jews to communists. They published all their material and held all their meetings in Yiddish. Yiddish is inherently a Jewish expression. It's a Jewish language. So they tried to use a sense of Jewish identity to make people communist. And many leading socialists and communists in the mainstream parties were Jewish. Of course, who's the most famous Jewish communist?
Marx.
Trotsky. Yeah, Trotsky. But Brodstein. Leonid Brodstein, who got axed in the end in 1940. Anarchism. There was an anarchist movement, particularly in Russia. It was underground, but Jews were involved in that. In fact, one of the people who blew up the Tsar's train and killed the Tsar in 1881 was a Jewish anarchist. Of course, we have traditional Orthodoxy, which was huge, right? Much greater percentage of the population than it is today. You don't go to Zion until God sends the Messiah. All right? It's as simple as that. And in fact, they were anti-nationalists. They pointed to Jewish history, the corruption of the Maccabees, the destruction of the temples, the Bar Kokhba revolt, 132 to 135, which brought tremendous suffering on the Jewish people. And they pointed to the Talmud in Ketubot 111a, where it says there are three oaths. Let me see if I get them all right. One is that you shouldn't go up against the wall, which means you shouldn't go up against the other nations. You shouldn't go to the lands of Israel without permission of the other nations. This is assuming, this was the out of the Zionists, particularly the religious Zionists, assuming that they don't oppress you too much. Assuming that they don't oppress you too much. And by the way, many religious Zionists and others said in 1947, when the United Nations gave permission for a Jewish state, they voted on it in November 1947, they said the nations have given permission. We can go forth. So Zionism had to fight religious trends, it had to fight secular trends, had to fight all types of trends. The only, there was a debate, by the way, religiously between Maimonides and Nachmanides. And when we say a debate in Jewish history, nobody has a face-to-face debate. They lived about 100 years apart. They debate on text, and then people comment, and that's Talmud, and so on, and so on. The only ism Jews were against was monarchism. It was obvious. Why? Because the monarchy generally didn't favor them. However, certain Jews, as we mentioned a few moments ago, had favored status. They were shtadlanim, or shtadlans as they were called, and they were the intermediaries of the Jewish community with the ruling group. All right. Any questions on that so far? So that is Zionism in context.
The only thing I would add to that, that's what was happening in Europe.
Correct. Correct. In the Eastern communities, there really was no Zionism at this point in the late 1880s. The only place where you did see an inkling of it was in Yemen. And in Yemen, you did see several hundred Yemenite Jews in 1903, 1904, came to the land of Israel, particularly because they were artisans. They settled in cities such as in Jerusalem and set up shops there. And there are some Yemenites today who can trace their heritage to that in the land of Israel. Most of them came later. The Yemenites, for example, came in Operation Magic Carpet in 1950, which is when most of them came. But Zionism is directly a result of European nationalism and the throes of what was going on in Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century. So you need to understand, Zionism didn't come out of nothing. Didn't come out of anything, or didn't come out of nothing. Didn't come out of nothing. And that it was seen as part of something. And there were, by the way, you know, there were some people who argued, and sometimes it was the case, in the 1910s and 1920s, Zionists ran for parliament. A couple of them won in local parliaments. Right? Zionists were part and parcel of the community and community leadership. And then, unlike now, if you were a Jew, you were a member of the Jewish community, which meant something different then. It was much more of a nationalist approach. And you would say, I'm a Zionist. And of course, what we're going to get to is there are all types of Zionists. Does anyone remember the different types of Zionists? The main types?
Political, cultural.
Political, cultural, religious. And we're going to get to a little about that too. There's all types of stratas going on here. Because what do we know about Jews? I like to say two Jews, three opinions, four subcommittees, five resolutions, six break-off groups, and on the seventh day, they decided not to rest anyway. Alright, so that's the echo through the ages. This is the echo through the ages. That was that point. That was modern Zionism, and this is Zionism in history. It doesn't come from nothing. A couple words first. Since the beginning of the Jewish people, there has been a longing for the concept of Zion. Sometimes Zion means a place. Sometimes it's an emotion. Sometimes it's a specific place, the Temple Mount. Sometimes it's the land of Israel. Sometimes it's the city of Jerusalem, which is also known as the city of David. But the concept of Zion, no matter what you call it, is part of the DNA of the Jewish people. It's in the fabric of the Jewish people. We have some proof texts here, and I'm going to go through them real briefly. This is the most popularized and one we know most. We say it every Shabbat, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, from Zion goes forth the Torah. We say that when we take the Torah, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah. Others that are popular, for the sake of Zion, I will not be silent. If you go in Jerusalem, that's often on various signs. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat, Psalm 137. I didn't get the Hebrew for that, but that's something that we say too.
It's a good reggae song. Also.
It's a good what?
Reggae song.
It's a good reggae song? Who sings it, you know?
A descendant of Haile Selassie.
Oh, really? That's great. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, in Eshkachecha, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Eshkachech, thank you. In Eshkachech, Yerushalayim, Eshkachech et Yemini. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, and my right hand forget its cunning. You know, it's incredible writing. It's very, very, very moving. This is in the Psalms. You know, it's hard to say when it was written, really, but it's at least 2,000 years old. And what it means is this concept was part and part of the Jewish people. We say to people, when we first see them, or when people pass away, may be comforted amongst the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. We mourn the fact for many years that Zion and Jerusalem were not in Jewish control. It's interesting, by the way, that in modern times, no one has gotten rid of this. Right? You would think, well, Jerusalem's in, you know, the control of the Jewish people now. But there's been no movement that I know of to get rid of it, although there has been a movement to add certain prayers and maybe change certain other things, but that one sticks around. All right, so we talked a little bit about Zionism as secular Jewish messianism. What I also want you to know is that Zionism started in the modern era, actually, by some Orthodox rabbis in the mid-19th century, Kalischer and Alkali. They were relatively obscure rabbis. Alkali was in Sarajevo. Kalischer was in Eastern Europe. They wrote several books. They started societies. This was in the 1830s to the 1860s, roughly. And they didn't get much of a following. However, we know that Theodor Herzl's grandfather was one of the followers of Kalischer, or one of Theodor Herzl's grandfathers. And we think that this is one of the major influences on Theodor Herzl, so that's of significance. But it really started religiously, because it really wasn't until the 1850s, 1860s, that Jews in Eastern Europe started secularizing. They had already done that in Central Europe. Remember, the first Reform Temple opened in Hamburg in 1817. So in the German-speaking lands, because there's no Germany, per se, until 1871. So we're also talking about Austria and the Habsburg Empire all around. But it actually started with them. And what they were doing is they were building on a sentiment, and they were being captivated, particularly in the case of Kalischer, with Alkali, with the sense of nationalism that was surging throughout the Balkans at that time. If you want to understand what's going on in Jewish history at any given point, look at what's going on in the general society. For example, I hear there's something called assimilation that the American Jewish community is facing. Are any other American communities facing that? Name one? Catholics. Catholics facing a major problem with assimilation. Mainstream Protestant churches. To put it in perspective, depending on the study you want to look at, we're 5.6 million to 7.2 million Jews in this country. Well, they are many tens of millions. Right? What's going on in the general society is happening in the Jewish society. We're special, but we're not special in that way. Right? And that actually is a really good thing, because it enables people to get together and strategize together. And there was some strategy going on between various groups in these eras as well. The Reform community, by the way, that I mentioned a few moments ago, Zionist or not Zionist? Any thoughts?
Non-Zionist.
Non-Zionist. rejected Zionism, classical reform. Anybody remember or know why they rejected Zionism? Because they said, this is it. Where we live, this is it. In fact, we don't want to rebuild the temple. This is our temple. And until today, almost every Reformed congregation is a temple so-and-so. And that's how that started, because they said, this is now our temple. All right, so the Reformed community was officially non-Zionist. They took references to the Messiah out of their prayers. They took references to Zion, and not Jerusalem, but to Zion out of their prayers. There's a prayer at the end of the traditional Amidah that talks about hoping that the temple is speedily rebuilt in our days. Gone in the Reformed prayer books, optional in most conservative prayer books, mandatory in most Orthodox prayer books, right? And there's a lot of examples about that. And that's always fascinates me, because you can kind of figure out what's going on in the community at that time by how they change the prayer books. And I have actually have a collection of old prayer books at home, particularly the Reformed movement. They seem to put... Does anybody here belong to a Reformed congregation? So how many Reformed prayer books have you had in your lifetime?
Since I've been a member there.
Yeah.
One, two, three, four.
Right.
And they're looking at parts of the Rosh Hashanah and the High Holiday service, and there's a draft for the afternoon service.
So there you go.
That we're looking at. That
right.
People didn't like.
The Reform movement changes more quickly.
Okay.
The Reform movement changes more quickly. I'm not going to have the debate of whether or not that's good or bad. That's a fact. Right? Their appeal, and I happen to believe that every Jewish stream appeals to a certain group of people in its era and contributes in its own way in its era. It's very politically correct of me. I actually believe it, too. All right. How are we doing on time? We're fine and dandy. All right, so let's talk for a moment, as we did. Actually, no, before I get to the Basel platform, but you can look at it if you want to. I want to talk about the different kinds of Zionism we named before. Yeah, Mitch.
Hey, can I go back just to answer a quick question?
Yeah, do you want me to move the slide back?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
So has there ever been as much a period in Jewish history where there's been as much assimilation as there is now, and what was
right.
The outcome of that?
Okay, so the answer is yes, and it was a bloody outcome. It was called the Maccabee Wars. There was a high level of assimilation, maybe 50% of the community. Let's see, the Maccabee Revolt was 165 to 68 BCE, I believe. I know it ended in 165. I can't remember exactly when it started. People were running to the gymnasia, the gymnasium. They were reversing their circumcisions, which... I don't understand how, but apparently it was a very painful procedure, which they did. They were emulating the dress. Now, I also hesitate to say that because it was different, because nationalism and belonging to a group was very different as well. I will also add there was a high level of situation for the second generation of followers of Jesus, who were all Jewish initially, right? By the droves, they left Judaism. So it's kind of hard to compare eras, but you know, there have been other times of massive change in the identity and affiliation of people who started out Jewish. So from our perspective today, and you look at the statistics, it's pretty frightening. You know, just a quick commercial, one of my core beliefs is if I were to project 50 to 100 years down the road, it would be very bad for American Jewish community. However, if I were to say to you in 1987, that in the next 12 years, 1.1 million Jews are going to leave the Soviet Union, you would say I'm crazy. If I were going to tell you in 1966 that the Jewish people were going to gain the West Bank and Jerusalem and so on throughout history, you'd say I'm crazy. Jewish history is not predictable. We can only project... And we probably shouldn't project too far, but it's not predictable. So I'm disheartened and heartened at the same time when I look at it that way. But the answer to your question is there have been great moments of turmoil and upheaval with the Jewish people, particularly in, actually I shouldn't say in Eastern lands, because that was in Palestine, Israel, the time of Jesus, and it's really second generation.
There are two sides of that. One is what other people do to Jews, and mm-hmm. what the Jews do themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at the Talmud, by the way, it says that what Jews do to themselves is more important. It says that the Jews who brought about the destruction of the Second Temple were a result of two Jews fighting. And then they went to the Romans, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, and I always get them mixed up, so you can look it up. Every time I do, I forget it. All right, so let's take a look. We mentioned political Zionism. Somebody give me a refresher. What is political Zionism? Mitch?
That we should establish the state.
And we should do it through the means of addressing the leaders of other nations. Right, it's a political movement. That's why Theodor Herzl, we see him traipsing all across Europe until his early death at the age of 40 in 1904. That's why we see all these appeals by so many people to various wealthy, influential people. Baron Rothschild, will you please go talk to, you know, the leader of France, the leader of England, and so on and so on. Theodor Herzl and Max Nordau, who was in his day one of the most famous writers of the mid to late 19th century, were political Zionists. The inheritors of the Zionist movement would go and merge that with something called cultural Zionism. Does anybody remember the hero, or the not the hero, but the ideologue? Achad Ha'am, whose name literally in Hebrew means one of the people, and that's Asher Ginsberg is his original name. He worked for a little tea company you might have heard of called Vysotsky, or Vysotsky Tea. If you want a lot of Vysotsky tea, go to the Russian produce store on Reisterstown Road. I go there every Thursday evening or Friday afternoon. It's great. Have you been there? It's an awesome place. Can't understand a word the labels say, but you know, the fruit and produce is good and cheap.
And you point.
Huh?
Do a lot of pointing.
Yeah.
A lot of pointing.
Yeah. My problem is in Russian I can only say, do you speak English or do you speak Hebrew? That's it. But anyway, cultural Zionists, anybody know what they believed? Cultural Zionists believe that you guys, particularly Achad Ha'am in his writings, and Achad Ha'am's first famous writing was in 1889, and it's called This Is Not the Way, Zelo Aderech. He went to visit the colonies in Palestine. Remember that, by the way, I don't try and offend anybody by using the word Palestine. It was Palestine until 1948. All right, so my mother-in-law has Palestine as her place of birth on her passport. So 1882 is when we actually saw the first European settlers go there. It was a group of 16 young adults who came from Kharkov, it's called, a city in what's now Ukraine. And they went and founded a colony there. It's part of the movement called BILU, B-I-L-U, which was an acronym for Hebrew Beit Yaakov Lechu Unechu, the House of Jacob will go up and go forth. They were what we call practical Zionists, which we'll get to in a moment. But cultural Zionists said, you're just not going to build a homeland with this little pishkala, 15 people here, 35 people there. You're talking about a country that has about 750,000 Arabs. They don't want you. You don't have permission from the Sultan to settle there, even though Herzl's going around saying, oh, Sultan, please meet me, and groveling. What you need to do is nurture those little communities, get Hebrew speakers, make Zion the center of the spoke wheel that goes out, influence the diaspora, so your Zionist program has to be not this ridiculous political stuff, which we're going to talk about. What it needs to be is the fact that in the diaspora, you're going to be teaching Hebrew. You're going to be teaching about the history of the land. You're going to be teaching the love of the land. And then in a generation or two, you'll have educated enough people to go there and make viable communities. But it's enough of what we call this Chalukah Yid. Anybody know Yiddish Chalukah Yid? Chalukah Yid is a Jew who comes from Europe to settle in the land of Israel and is totally dependent on contributions from abroad. Now that, by the way, is a theme we're going to see when we get to some stuff between Ben-Gurion and a guy named Blaustein from Baltimore in 1950 when they talk about the obligations of Jews in the diaspora to the land of Israel, the Jews of Israel. And some people argue today, all they want from us is our money. Right? That's part of the argument, at least. So Chada'am said, this is what you have to build. So that's cultural Zionism. So we just did political, and we just did cultural. Along comes a guy named David Ben-Gurion and his followers, who we're going to talk about in detail. Might be in the first half, might be in the second half. They merge these two. They say yes and yes. Of course we need practical political Zionism. We have to do everything we can to get the support of the leaders of the world. And of course we need cultural Zionism. We need to nurture these communities, and we need people in the diaspora doing more. And we need to encourage people to come to the land of Israel, particularly young people. And by the way, there's a lot of pressure building up in Europe because things are getting lousier and lousier for the Jews. We're starting to see pogroms from 1881 forward in spasms based on what's happening. And we get some really nasty people leading the Russian government, like this interior minister named Pobonetsov. Pobonetsov had what he, in the late 1890s, had a one-third solution for the Jewish people, for the Jewish problem. Anybody remember what the Jewish problem was, or the Jewish question that they talked about? Simple. What do we do with the Jews? What do we do with the Jews? One-third solution. We're going to starve one-third. We're going to convert one-third. One-third are going to emigrate. We're going to starve one-third. Convert one-third. One-third's going to emigrate. One-third we're going to kill, and one-third we're going to convert. That's how we're going to deal with the Jewish problem. Pressure is building, so the earlier slide about all those various things, anarchism, communism, socialism. Jews who said, you want me to go where? To a place that doesn't have running water? You want me to go to a place with 650,000 Arab Muslims who don't want me? A place without roads? I mean, one of the things that the early pioneers did, particularly in the 1920s and the early years of the British administration, was they actually built roads. Right? We had the Gedut HaAvodah, the work battalions. They actually took rocks and smoothed them out and kind of made these steamrollers and built roads. But they were roads to their settlements. It doesn't matter. There weren't any roads there before. All right, so now we did political, we did cultural, and we did practical. And we, of course, talked about religious. Anybody remember what religious Zionism was based on?
They're trying to find the source of authority in the Bible.
Right, because that's what you do when you're religious. You need a proof text, right?
Can you also, just in your succinct way, talk about the motivations of the strands of Zionism? Because
absolutely.
It really then sets the stage for the tensions that...
Absolutely. Let me do this real quickly, and I'm going to get right to that. The hero of religious Zionism was a guy named Rav Kook, or Rabbi Kook, K-O-O-K. Rav Kook died in 1935. He came to the land of Israel, Palestine, in 1905. He was part of that second Aliyah, and we're going to talk about the various ways of the Aliyot in a few minutes. Rav Kook did something that no religious thinker ever did before him. And he was a mystic. He was a really fascinating, fascinating guy. He said, we have to go to the land of Israel because the Messiah is knocking on the door. This is our opportunity. And these secular Jews, I need to cooperate with them because they don't know it, but they are God's agents. They are God's unknowing partners. So he sacratized? Is that a word? Sacratized? Made sacred, yeah, but I like sacratized. So he sacratized these people, which enabled a partnership between what's now known as the modern Orthodox and the secular. Today, by the way, the modern Orthodox are the vanguard of the Israeli army. Until the 1970s and early 80s, it was the kibbutz members because of their ideology. Today, the ideology, the motivation, is with the modern Orthodox, who are also, by the way, the backbone of the settlement movement. So it gets very convoluted. And there are splits in that camp, too. But this all started back then. And indeed, there was a historic partnership, which we'll talk about in a few weeks, between the modern Orthodox and the Secular Labor Party from 1949 to 1977. For those years, from 49 to 77, every government, which was a labor-led government, had the National Religious Party as a member. It was called the Grand Arrangement or something like that. I'll have to look up the Hebrew in it. All right, so those are the different kinds of Zionism. And Marshall just asked me to try and summarize. Succinctly tell me what you wanted one more time. Something, the strand?
The motivation.
Motivations, okay. Cultural Zionists were motivated by a dislike of the secularism of the political Zionists and a belief that Jewish culture was deeper than politics. Cultural Zionists grew up religious and were increasingly secular, but couldn't get rid of their religious identity. It's who they were, it's where they were from. So for example, my father-in-law grew up in Mea Shearim in Jerusalem, ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. He went to a yeshiva. Today, he drives on Shabbat and watches TV. And I have seen my father-in-law say to my kids from across the room, take this Torah, open it up, read three words, and I'll finish the paragraph for you. And he does it. So he couldn't get rid of it. There are a lot of people like that. He's also still a Torah reader, his shul that he drives to and all that. He's a man of many paradoxes, but he's a good dude. He's a good, strictly kosher, though. Political Zionists said, we don't need this. They all came from assimilated backgrounds. Many of them were from Central Europe, German speakers. They said, we don't need this hubbub, mysticism, incantations of religion. What we need, since we're nationalists, is a Jewish homeland. And what we're going to do is go to the great powers and say, hey, everyone's getting their homeland. It's our turn. Then the religious Zionists, not the non-Zionists, said, God is telling us this is the time. There is great turmoil in the world. And Rob Cook goes into this in depth in his writings. He writes about World War I as proof that the Messiah is coming, because the world is in upheaval. So the Messiah is coming. He called it Ikvut HaMashiach, the footsteps of the Messiah. They talk about the birth pangs of the Messiah. And practical. Practical Zionists said, we're taking the best of both worlds, but not religious. We're taking the best of political and cultural, and we're making it our own as we settle the land. Does that clear it up a little bit?
Well, it wasn't unclear. I just thought it would be good to follow that.
Okay.
One thing
I think
that I would supplement is how the political Zionists were really motivated by protection of Jews from anti-Semitism.
Yes,
While they had Jewish characteristics, they weren't interested necessarily in establishing a state or society where Jewish ritual and Jewish cultural values will flourish. But cultural and religious Zionism is very much about Judaism as opposed to Jews, or Jewish practices as opposed to
Herzl writes at length in his diaries, as do others, about the need to save the Jews, particularly of Eastern Europe. So there is some paternalism going on here, which we're also going to see when the Jews of Eastern Europe meet the Jews of the East. There's some paternalism going on there as well. Some would say there's still some paternalism going on today. But the Jews of Central Europe basically said, we're educated, we're wealthier, we need to save our brethren. So that was absolutely a motivation for them as well. The Jews of Eastern Europe, of course, basically said, just give us your money because we're the ones who are going to settle anyway. Lots of tension. In many regards, just like today in the Knesset, which I always say is a place of raucous democracy, the Zionist world wasn't always democratic. Herzl and others kind of forced things through at various times, but there was tremendous passion. And while you must have had a headache from that all the time, one wonders what our country would be like if there were more passion about what we consider to be very important issues. Right? I mean, I don't even know who the lieutenant governor candidate for the Republican candidate is. I should know that. right? Particularly when you read the recent polls. All right. So we've talked so far. Any questions until now? We've talked so far about the historical origins of Zionism. We've talked about Zionism in its time. We've talked about the strands of Zionism. A lot of this will change by around 1920. Oh, let me go through this first. I apologize. The Basel Platform. This was the Tabula Rasa. This was the founding document of the Zionist movement. The first Zionist Congress is held in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Theodor Herzl is the man of the hour. He is a Viennese-based playwright and journalist. He is extremely charismatic. He's well-known throughout Europe. He had just come back from France, where he spent 4 or 5 years working for a newspaper called the Neue Freie Presse, the New Free Press. And he famously saw Alfred Dreyfus. Anybody remember the story? Anyone want to share any details?
Captain in the French army. He was accused of being a traitor.
Well, I was selling
secrets to the Austrian-German military. And he was tried and convicted and sentenced.
Right.
And Herzl was in the crowd.
And what stunned Herzl the most...
He was part of France, and all of a sudden he was a Jew.
Not just that, but the crowd chanted, kill the Jew.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Kill the Jew.
And where was Libertas, Egalitas, and what's the third one?
Fraternity.
Founded, right? This is the first place in the world that... that's not the first place in the world that gave Jews freedom. The United States is, in 1776. It's the second place. 1790, the Sephardim in France got their freedom. 1791, the Ashkenazi in France got their freedom. Baltimore, born and raised, Arthur Hertzberg has written a great book called The History of the Jews of France. I recommend you read it if you ever get a chance. It's in the Baltimore Hebrew Institute Library. I know that because I've looked at it there at Towson University. And a lot of my books come from there, or my knowledge of them at least. I was the geek that on Sundays used to sit at BHU library reading room and just, you know, reading. I loved it. So Herzl is a guy who can open doors because he's still an influential journalist. So when he goes to Baron Rothschild in France and says, I want to meet with you, Rothschild says, sure, you know, I'll get my name in the newspaper. And he says, we got to settle 1 million Jews in the land of Israel. And Rothschild says, what, are you crazy? He literally throws him out. Herzl spends the rest of his life from the mid-1890s to 1904 trying to persuade people of this. He writes a famous book. Anybody remember what it's called in 1895? That's Alte Neuland, The Old New Land. That's the second one. That's from 1903. The first one is Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. The Jewish State, which is a boring, dry book. Right? But it's got a lot of interesting stuff in there that's come true. Alte Neuland, which we read, is a wonderful vision by Herzl of what the land of Israel will look like by the year 1920.
Yes.
I mean, you go to the opera, one night you go to the Italian opera, one night you go to the French opera, one night you go to the Viennese opera, and what have you.
You got it right, except you should have said restaurants instead of operas.
Exactly. He gathers about, I can't remember the exact number, several hundred Jewish representatives from all over Europe, primarily Eastern Europe, to come to Basel. He does it up. He's a man of the media. So he gets all the journalists to come there. He puts on a top hat and a tuxedo. It's in a nice hall. Anybody ever been to that hall in Basel? I've actually never been there. I'd like to go there one day. It's still there. It's a museum now. And he regally walks in, and everybody stands and applauds, and he declares, a Jewish state shall be born. This is what he says. Can I get someone to read this for me? But that's what they come up with. Volunteer? Don't be shy. Don't make me call. I'll call your mother.
Yeah. Zionism aims at establishing for the Jewish people a publicly and legally assured home in Palestine. For the attainment of this purpose, the Congress considers the following means serviceable. 1, the promotion of the settlement of Jewish agriculturists, artisans, and tradesmen in Palestine, to the Federation of All Jews into local or general groups according to the laws of the various countries. 3, the strengthening of the Jewish feeling and consciousness. 4, preparatory steps for the attainment of those governmental grants which are necessary to the achievement of the Zionist purpose.
So I'm a rabbi in Eastern Europe. I'm a big shot rabbi, a macher rabbi. And I'm so connected that what I say can influence about 2 million people. About 2 million people. Is there anything in there that makes me feel good? Anything? I'm watching these Zionists to see if I can work with them. Hmm? I don't think so. So the rabbis say, forget it, you're not next on The Price is Right. So the strengthening of Jewish feeling and consciousness? Come to shul. You know? The attainment of the governmental grants? What the governmental grants? Promotion of settlement of Jewish agricultures? We're not agriculturalists. You know, come on. Federation of all Jews into local or general groups? These guys don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're talking about. All right, let's see what we got next coming up here. Waves of Aliyot. How are you? Actually, we're right at 7 o'clock right now, right?
It's
8 o'clock. 8 o'clock, whatever, yeah. My watch, cheap watch from Target, because I lose them all the time, it's set on London time. I can never calculate it. I can't figure out how to change it. It says 12:57. Look at that, man. Tell them the truth.
How long have you had
it? Oh, my goodness.
Your watch?
A month or two. Yeah, spent another $2. No, I hit it one day, and it changed. It's so cheap.
Get your kids to fix it.
That's true. They're too busy playing video games. All right, we're going to take a 5-minute break.
I'm going to talk about the trip also.
Okay, I'm going to get a drink. So I forgot to mention earlier, if you're new to the class and or need a refresher, this is a great book. And she has recommended readings at the end of each chapter for additional stuff. And it's part of the syllabus. And you see what I tried to do on the syllabus this year as well is I gave you some recommendations for additional readings. And I'm always happy to recommend some more. This book actually is really, I really enjoyed this book. I didn't know it before the beginning of this class, but the introductions to the documents and the documents themselves are really quite good. So we have some great ones. And I've actually, of course, already gone through the other book by Gershom Gorenberg on the origins of the settler movement or the settlements movement. From 67 to 77. By the way, why did he stop in 77? Anyone know? What happened in 77? Somebody was elected prime minister.
Likud,
Menachem Begin. Which, so what he really does so convincingly is spell out in detail how the settlement movement was birthed by the labor movement. And a lot of it had to do with internal strife in the labor party. For example, Yigal Alon fighting against Moshe Dayan and Yitzhak Rabin fighting against Shimon Peres, who allowed for settlements, although a decade and a half later we become the guy that said we're going to give it all back. So, and boy, you could give a whole course on Peres because he's just been so fascinating in his career. Whether you like him or don't like him, he's been fascinating. All right. Do we have anybody want any additional commentary or discussion on anything we talked about in the first half? I know we're tossing out a lot, so don't be shy. One of the things that was going on... Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
just a thought in terms of Palestine at that time, as you said, was under the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the conditions that existed there?
Sure.
Because I think that's also a factor in terms of why people may or may not have come so quickly.
Absolutely. So... from roughly the late 1400s until 1917, the land of Israel was ruled by the Ottoman Turks. Ottoman Turks ruled it until 1917. The Ottoman Turks themselves would survive in power until about 1922, with a much lesser landmass in those last 5 years. The Ottoman Turks were horrible rulers. Their empire was known as the sick man of Europe, particularly the last few hundred years. Life in Palestine was difficult. The majority of the population were what were known as fellahin, or not itinerant farmers, just poor farmers. They would farm plots of land for centuries, and they might not own that land. It might be owned by somebody who lived in Istanbul. This would become a major problem in 1948, when the Jews would have the land, and the farmers would say, "This is my family's land. I've had this land for hundreds of years, and the Jews would say, "Show me the deed." He said, "We don't have a deed. We've lived here for hundreds of years. You know, my great times 26 grandfather is buried in that little rocky cemetery over there." Oh, this was, I shouldn't say 1948. It became a problem during the British administration when Jewish communities were setting up yeshuvim. Jewish communities were setting up on hilltops in various places. It was a clash of cultures. It was a clash of bureaucracies. Life was so bad that there were basically no doctors in the whole country. When the Jews came, certainly if you didn't live in the city, when the Jews came, one of the things they did, some of them, is they set up clinics, and they served a whole bunch of people. When Jews like Henrietta Soult set up Hadassah and Hadassah Hospital in the 1920s and 1930s, they served everybody, and they still do. These people had never had such service before. Mortality rate was very high. I said earlier there were no paved roads. There was no purified water. There was a middle class or upper middle class in certain cities. They were disproportionately Christian. There was a much higher percentage of Christian Arabs in Israel until 1948. They were the ones with money, so they started leaving in 1936 when the Arab Revolt began. They went to Beirut, they went to Damascus, they went to Cairo, they went to places like that. It wasn't a nice place to be. Basically, nobody said, "I can't wait to move to Palestine," other than a handful of Meshuggah Jews. And the truth of the matter is, also, when the Jews started arriving and building an economy, Arabs started coming from some of the other countries because jobs were there. Right now, these were low-paying jobs, but they were better than what they had back home. So everything that we know of today as a problem began then. But to answer your question, in general, life was lousy there. Life was lousy there. In 1917, the British came in. They defeated the Turks in Palestine, and then they would rule the country until midnight May 14th, 1948. All right. Good?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. I like those types of questions. Please, I encourage you guys to ask those types of questions. Waves of Aliyot. We've talked about the tumult that was taking place in Europe in the late 1800s. And remember, there were wars in the German-speaking lands. There were wars in Italy, right, unifications. There was a revolt going on in the Russian Empire. Remember 1905, the revolution that we had there. This was happening all over Europe. Nationalism was rising. It led to waves of Aliyot in part. There were many things that made people move to the land of Israel. Some was ideology. Some was the naivete of youth. Some was they were escaping something. Some were escaping traditional communities. Some were escaping parents they didn't like. Some said, "Hey, I have nothing better to do. I don't want to go into my father's business." You know, whatever that might be. The first ones we mentioned earlier were the Bilu, and these early communities were funded by Baron Rothschild, based in France. Based in France. The people who go to Israel are known as Olim, or the ones who rise up. This is Olim from 1920. And I like this because a majority, I think all of the people in the photograph are women, and you don't really see too many pictures like this from that era. You always see some women with a lot of men, which is kind of neat. There were actually some later In the late 1920s, actually 1925, 26, through the 1930s, there were some women training kibbutzim. Women would come and learn and stay for a year, year and a half on a certain kibbutz. They would learn various things about, you know, milking cows or working fields, and then they would go off to mainstream established kibbutzim. These people were from a religious background, but they were secular. And we talked about that. They all came from something. That, by the way, is one of the great things to me about this generation of Jews, which we desperately need in this country. They all learned Jewish stuff when they were kids, and then they made a choice. That's fine. But they know something. Right? You can have the conversation, I like to say. That's the first Aliyah. It ended really 1903, 1904, because of the Japanese-Russian War. Right? It's, you couldn't leave Russia, basically, at that time. Then it's, and Russia got pummeled in that war, surprisingly. Led to all types of things internally in their government. Second Aliyah goes until World War I. Then the gates of Europe are closed shut. Rav Kook, who we spoke about a few moments ago, was stuck in Switzerland. He was at a conference of a group called Agudat Yisrael, or Aguda, which some of you know today. They're what we call ultra-Orthodox or Haredi Orthodox. He went to try and persuade them to become Zionists. He got stuck in Europe. He basically wound up then. He went to England. He spent the war years in England until 1920, actually, so 2 years after the war, when he went back. These were the folks who were ideologues. Ben-Gurion shows up in 1905. Yitzhak Ben-Zvi shows up that year. He becomes president of Israel. Lots of people do. They're revolutionaries. They're ideologues. They're raised religious still, including a guy like Ben-Gurion. By the way, Shimon Peres, do you know he was raised Haredi? He talks, if you ever see stuff about him talking about his life, about his grandfather teaching him Talmud. And it's very touching. That's one of the reasons why Shimon Peres always had a good relationship with the Haredi rabbis in Israel. He would always persuade them to serve in his government. Wouldn't always do what they wanted, but he could have the conversation. They were socialists. Third Aliyah starts right after the war. The British have arrived. The British are here. Things are stabilizing. Civilization as we know it. High tea. They were raised secular. That's why they were a little different. Some of them were fleeing because of what was going on in Russia. The communists and the socialists were losing. It went to roughly 1923, because that's when there was a depression, economic depression, that hit Europe. Then this should say 24 to 32 for the fourth Aliyah. Obviously, what happens in 1933? Hitler comes to power January 1st, 1933. This is called the German Aliyah. The majority of Jews who come aren't German. They're Polish. The majority of Jews come, but the German Jews are shopkeepers. They're middle class, as are a lot of the Polish refugees. They leave their mark on the country, particularly cities like Tel Aviv, 1933. We're going to talk about Tel Aviv a little more in a few moments, hopefully. We'll get to it because, you know, I always, everybody knows, right? You know, if I get through most of my material, that's a pretty good night. Yeah?
I think it's important to mention also that the fourth Aliyah, which is different from the first and third, is that America was essentially closed immigration.
Yes, 1924 to 1925, there were some acts of Congress that closed off immigration to this country. From 1881 till, you know, we want to say 1914 and then 1918 to 1924, 2.4 million Jews, maybe 2.6 million Jews come into this country. The country of choice is always America in the modern era. If you ask any of the Soviet Jews where they wanted to go, right, I'd say 7 or 8 out of 10 would have said America. They weren't allowed to come here. You know, the State Department has a quota of how many people can come from each country into this country. Tragically, before World War II, it wasn't met for Germany and Poland and France and, you know, all the places that, you know, became such tragic graveyards.
Not to get off topic, but yeah. The Soviet Aliyah that came, there mm-hmm. was a big fight as to whether, you know, among the Jewish mm-hmm. communities, federations, as to what number to allow. There was a
right.
conflict with Israel. And
there was a big issue of something, particularly in the 70s, in the early 80s of something called the Noshrim. Noshrim are those who fall away. So the Jews from the Soviet Union would go to Israel and ostensibly get on a plane and come to Detroit or Boston or Chicago or Baltimore, right? And that was a big bone of contention between the Israelis and the Americans, because we're sending you money to settle these people. Now we got to settle these people here? So there's been a whole bunch of tensions over that as well. But each wave of Aliyah made its mark on the country. Very important. And then there are other waves that I didn't talk about, which we're going to go into in depth in the course, which is after World War II, we have a wave of Holocaust survivors that come in. Then after the 48, early 49 war, we have a wave of Jews, different waves of Jews, coming from primarily Arab-speaking lands. So they all made their mark and continue to make their mark. Of course, Israel's had an Ethiopian wave. It's had several Soviet and then Russian waves. There was a mini-American wave after the Six-Day War in 1967. Not big, but, you know, it made its mark. All right, let's see where we're at in here. Those are the waves of Aliyot. One of the things I just want to take a few moments to mention that there was a big fight over that a lot of people don't know or talk about is what language should be spoken by the Jews in the land of Israel. Now, we of course today say Ivrit, Hebrew. But what language did most of the early Jews, or early ones speak?
Yiddish.
They all understood Yiddish, some Russian. The German language was the one of the Zionist movement. Theodor Herzl published a daily newspaper, a Zionist newspaper called Die Welt, The World. It published in German. That's what he thought was the most important language. And in fact, we have a movement, a revolt almost, in Israel against the funders, sounds like a page from the modern headlines, who want the country to speak Yiddish, I mean German instead. So the man who saw it a little differently and made it his life's mission, and who you know of, is named Eliezer Ben Yehuda. Anybody have that? I have that at home. I have a couple of them, but that's always been... I have that from Hebrew school days, you know, so it's not real new. Eliezer Ben Yehuda was a madman. Let me give you a couple details about Eliezer Ben Yehuda's life. He's probably the only one I'm going to go into depth about tonight. Let's see. Where did I put that? So, I'll just tell you, he's credited more than anyone else with the institution of Hebrew as a language. He turned to his wife one day, and he said, in Hebrew, "We're just going to speak Hebrew from now on." She didn't know Hebrew. Not only did she not know Hebrew, nobody knew Hebrew. There was no Hebrew language. But he forced his wife to learn Hebrew. And then when his son was born in Israel, after he got there in the early 1880s, he lived in the old city in Jerusalem, he said, "We're only going to speak Hebrew to this boy." He was the first Hebrew-speaking child on the planet. Or at least, I guess, since... You know, in modern Hebrew, at least since ancient times, his son, who I think died just a few years ago, made it his guts for it. And he wrote a couple books about it, too, because he felt ostracized. He couldn't play with any kids because he didn't understand what they were saying. And his father was busy working all his life on his compendium that became a 17-volume dictionary of the Hebrew language. And he published a newspaper in Hebrew. Guess how many readers he had? Yeah, at first he had two. He forced his wife to read it. Right. But he pushed, and he pushed, and he pushed. And the new immigrants who came, particularly as we got into the second Aliyah, 1904, 1905, wanted to speak Hebrew. And eventually Hebrew became the predominant language there. But that wasn't before there was a fight at first. We've all heard of the Technion in Haifa. Well, I think, let me check the year. I believe it was in 1912. It was the center of what's known as the War of Languages. Technion was funded by a German organization called Ezra. It was an educational organization. They funded schools around the world. The Technion was just established, and some of the professors and others wanted to declare that the language of study would be German, because that was the most sophisticated language in the world, of course, from the most sophisticated culture in the world. And there was a bit of a revolt. So people were taking out advertisements in newspapers decrying this. They were going back and forth. There was a big meeting in Berlin about it. The Ezra group didn't want to budge. So there was, in the good Jewish socialist fashion, a whole bunch of strikes in the land of Israel. They said, we're not going to your schools. The teachers said, we're not going to teach at your schools. The students said, we're not going to be students there anymore. And eventually, Ezra relented. And from that moment on in 1912, but it wasn't until 1912, Hebrew was the predominant language of the Jewish community in Palestine. So it was no guarantee. And of course, Herzl and his movement said German, right? And of course, Jews spoke many languages in a place like that. And by the way, it's far from unusual in a country to speak more than one language. Look at the old Yugoslavia, right? Depending on what neighborhood you were in, you had to speak a certain language. All right, we spoke about the Ottoman Turks. But anyway, there's Eliezer Ben Yehuda, as we know him best, at work. All right, we're fast-forwarding now. We're coming up to the Balfour Declaration. Before, now this was in the middle of World War I. And the Brits, as many countries have done throughout the years, probably gave a little too much credo to Jewish power. Right? The Russians have done this as well. And Jews have, by the way, throughout history, learned to use it to their advantage. Theodor Herzl used it to his advantage. Theodor Herzl would go to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire and say, by the way, if you grant us the right to establish a Jewish homeland, not a country, but a homeland in Palestine, I'm sure, wink, wink, we can get the wealthy Jews, like the Rothschilds of the world, to retire your debt. Because after all, we're all powerful Jews. And we can do that. And the Russians, to an extent, not to an extent, we know from the records, overemphasized Jewish power too. They were always a little concerned about it. The Soviets as well. And some would say, although not me, God forbid, that in this country some people think the Jews are politically more connected and powerful than they really are. Right? And maybe it's the case. Anybody ever go to an AIPAC convention? And so, you ever been to the banquet at night? Senator so-and-so, stand up. Senator so-and-so, stand up. Senator so-and-so, stand up. You go, holy cow. These, you know, AIPAC brings together more members of Congress in one place than anyone other than the Congress itself.
True.
When you hear that, you say, these guys have power. They're hyper-organized. They're hyper-organized. Anyway, Lord Rothschild of the Rothschild family, the banking family, was the leader of the Jewish community. He wasn't a religious Jew, but he was highly connected politically. And the way it worked in Britain at that time was that they would send a message to the leader of a community on behalf of the community. So I don't know if anyone can read this, but is anyone close enough to read it? If not, I'll read it for you, because this is the famous Balfour Declaration. I'll read it. This is from the foreign minister. His name, signature, I can't read. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. By the way, this is a direct result of the work of Chaim Weizmann, who moved to England in 1904. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. It's very nice of him. I'm going to, as we say, annotate this very quickly. Great Britain likes the thought of a national home for the Jewish people, not a Jewish state, not what Herzl wanted, not what a lot of the Zionists wanted, a national home. Who controls Palestine right now?
The
Turks. The Turks control Palestine. What's one of the things they're trying to do? Any thoughts?
Win the war.
Not just win the war.
Control Palestine and the routes to India and protection of the empire and oil and everything.
They're also looking for a fifth column of Jews in Eastern Europe. They're stirring Jewish sentiment on behalf of the Allies. Right. Right. And we use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. We'll work with you. This is a key phrase. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. You can have everything you want as long as the people who live there aren't bothered by it. That's going to be a problem. Or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Don't worry, we're not going to kick out our Jews if there's a Jewish homeland. That's what that says. So he's trying to appease everybody. There is dancing in the Jewish streets. I knew a woman when I lived in Atlanta in the 1990s. Her name was Balfoura Levine. She was named for the Balfour Declaration. Her parents were obviously Zionists. It was the beginning, official beginning, of the creation of the State of Israel. This is the first document that lays the groundwork for that. And there's going to be huge debates for the next 30 years as to what that really means, because it's contradictory. The Zionists see one thing in it. The Arabs aren't paying attention. They don't really care right now. But they are going to care when the British establish themselves. Okay, two other things happen. So the British in 1917 say, yeah, we're interested in the concept of a Jewish homeland. It becomes official that the Brits are going to rule Palestine, which includes what we now call Jordan, and the San Remo Conference, let's just say allied, not allied, powers divide the world. The French and the British and the Italians basically said, you're getting that as a colony, you're getting that as a colony, you're getting that as a colony, because they could. That's why they did it. The Brits get Palestine / Jordan. It doesn't become chopped in half until 1923, when it becomes Transjordan, and then eventually becomes Jordan. And I, for the life of me, I can find no reference as to what Transjordan means. You know, trans means passage or passing through, transit, but I can't find it. If anyone ever finds that, please let me know. 1923.
On the other side of the Jordan?
I guess. It's just, you know, but on the one hand, if you're standing on that side, you know, what's that mean?
There was nothing. No, the West didn't recognize anything on the other side. It was just until Baghdad. That was about the Jerusalem.
Right.
Yeah. Unless it's a scientific term, trans.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't
trans
know.
Fat.
What I always like to say, is it my right or your right?
Trans.
You know? It depends which side you're on. All right, 1923, the mandate through the League of Nations, which is the precursor, as we know, to the United Nations, says, yes, you have it officially, but the Brits had already said, you know, we're doing it anyway, we don't really care. They just rubber stamped it. They had instilled civilian rule in 1920. From 1917 to 1920, the land was under military rule. So that's when a first high commissioner, who's Herbert Samuel, comes over. Herbert Samuel, who is a nominal Zionist but Jewish, which thrills the Jewish community, and he does, from all the records, he does a pretty good job in terms of what's going on there. All right, so that brings us to some dates that I want to remind you of or let you know about. The Arab revolts. Unfortunately, there are spasms of violence during the 30 years in which the Brits rule the land of Israel. For more information, I can't remember if I put it on the syllabus, a guy named Tom Segev has written a book called One Palestine Complete, which is a phrase taken from one of the first documents Herbert Samuel has Herbert Samuel signed when he was arriving in Israel. So Tom Segev wrote One Palestine Complete, and it was obviously a complete rule from 1917 to 1948 or 47. Then again, you can say from 67 until present. 1920, our old friend Haj Amin Husseini makes his name. He's a nasty guy. There are two families until today that are the major clans in Palestinian society. It's the Husseini clan and the Nashashibi clan. The Nashashibis are moderates. They work with the Israelis, with the Jews. They were the ones who basically said, we might not like the Jews, but we have to live with them. Husseini said, no, this is our land. We need to kill them. Basically it. He was an ally of Hitler in World War II. He escaped from the British in World War II by hiding out in Berlin and making broadcasts in Arabic back to the Arab world about the need to revolt against the British. He unfortunately died peacefully in Lebanon, in Beirut, in 1973. There, if you want to look on YouTube, there's a ton of stuff about him. He's not a good guy. He whips up the masses in 1920, and there's a pattern, basically, that follows in all these riots. There are some speeches made. There are some riots that take place. Things get out of control. There's some Jewish self-defense. The British come to the aid to stop things a little too late. A lot of people are dead. It can start from a rumor. For example, the Hebron massacre and the Jerusalem riots start because there's a rumor that the Jews have changed the prayer arrangements at the Western Wall, that they've moved a screen, or I'm sorry, they set up a screen for Yom Kippur to divide men from women. By doing that, Husseini and others said, you've changed the status quo at the site. It violates the agreement. Horrendous violence. Some of you may have read the first-hand accounts of the massacre in Hebron in 1929. Basically wiped out the Jewish community in Hebron, which had been there since biblical times. And many of those Jews, but some of those Jews, I want to point out, were hidden by Arab neighbors. So not everybody's evil here, right? There's some bad people. But not everybody's evil. So after the 1921, the British put together one. The British did what they do best, they just like the United States does. They put together a commission of inquiry, if you want to call it that, or do a study. They put together, Winston Churchill was the secretary of the colonies at that time. The Churchill White Paper, which basically said, maybe fool. Emigration of Jews to this place is not the greatest idea right now. We need to look at limiting that and, taking that part of the Balfour Declaration that said, without prejudice to the inhabitants of the land, maybe we ought to take that a little more seriously. 36 to 39, that's formally known as the Arab Revolt. Anybody remember who Ord Wingate was?
Yeah, British military officer that came over to organize not only British efforts to combat the riots, but also he organized Jewish paramilitary forces. The Palmach was started by him.
Absolutely. Was it you or was it Marshall? Someone said, he was crazy
year. He was crazy.
Yeah.
He
was killed in Burma, right? In a plane crash?
Yeah.
But one of the things that he did was, and he really liked the Jews. He really liked the Zionists. And today, part of his legacy is there's something called the Ord Wingate Institute in Israel, and it's a sports and fitness center. And it's a very famous place in Israel. They do really neat work, particularly with handicapped or developmentally disabled kids. So it's really, really a neat legacy. So he said, he basically went to the Jewish leadership and said, look, I know that you guys have a military organization. I know that you guys are training in the kibbutzim at night. We all know that. I want to help you. I want to help you train. So we're going to set up these special night squads because these Arabs are coming around and they're blowing up our trains and they're attacking our patrols and they're running into the hills and we can't find them in the caves. So I'm going to teach you guys how to do ambushes. And I'm going to teach you guys military intelligence reconnaissance. this will come in very handy for the Jews. In fact, the Jews would take every opportunity the British gave them to learn how to fight. They did it in World War I. We didn't talk about it, but there was something called the Jewish Legion. They did it in World War II, although it didn't come to fruition outside of the land of Israel until very late toward the end of the war. And they did it here with the Palmach. And the Palmach literally means lightning strike force. And Palmach was the elite of the Haganah. Haganah means defense. The Hagen is to defend in Hebrew. So this is where you get people like Yigal Alon and Yitzchak Sadeh and Yitzchak Rabin. Right? Rabin is the commander of the Harel Brigade. They get all their training from the British. Who's training the Arabs? Nobody. That's going to make a huge difference, we're going to see, in 1948. The Arabs have overwhelming numbers. No question about it. Not any training.
They trained the Jordanian army.
The Jordanian army was commanded by a guy named Pasha Glob, who was a British guy. It was a better trained army, but it wasn't a great army. And, as we're going to see, in that war, King Abdallah of Jordan at that time held them back. He had an unofficial agreement with everybody that said, we're only going to take Jerusalem and the West Bank. We're not doing it. And I'm not going to listen to the other Arabs, which his grandson, King Hussein, would follow suit on. We don't know what would happen if he had pressed on more. They were a better trained army. And they had artillery, which was really important. And they had some planes, which was really important. But yeah, today it's no match. But back then, you're absolutely right. They were a better trained army. So, let's see. And here's an example of Jews being evacuated by the British from the old city. You know it's bad if the British come to you and say, by the way, we need to get you out of here because we know what just happened in Hebron.
All right. Neil.
Yeah.
Can you touch on Jabotinsky a little bit?
Yes. In fact, let me zoom forward to him. We'll come back. There he is. Zev Vladimir Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky, let me take my official notes, and then we're going to look quickly at something that he wrote called The Iron Wall, which is his view on the Arabs. I'm like the old crazy speaker at the podium who drops all his notes. There we go. Jabotinsky was brilliant. He was charismatic. He was multilingual. I think he spoke 7 languages. He grew up secular. He was a journalist. He came to fame under the pen name Altalina. Anybody know what the Altalina was?
The ship
that
the Irgun tried to.
No, that you're going to try to bring in.
Right. Yeah.
And you know who was the commander of the unit on the beach that off Tel Aviv that fired on the Irgun? Yitzchak Rabin. Yitzchak Rabin. Don't think that wasn't an issue for the rest of his life and Menachem Begin's life. All right, so let me find my beginning. All right. Jabotinsky was the founder of something called Revisionist Zionism, which is the forerunner of the Likud. Just so you know, as a side note, one of his secretaries at one point was a guy named Benjamin Netanyahu's father. So that's where Benjamin Netanyahu gets his ideology from, his father, who got it straight from the source. Revisionist Zionism was muscle Zionism. And Max Nordau, an early Zionist, had already written, we talked about muscle Jews. The Jews need to be big, bold, proud, and strong. They were maximalist Jews. They believed that it was a horrible compromise when the Jewish leadership under Ben-Gurion accepted the partition of Israel. Right? They said, no, Jordan's ours too. We're going to have to deal with the Arabs. They were very upfront about that. He was much more so than the labor Zionist, by the way, warning of tragedy coming in Europe in the early 1930s, and had a plan for evacuation of those Jews. Like many, he was shocked into Zionism by the 1903 pogroms in Kishinev, which were brutal at that time. It doesn't sound like much today. 50-some Jews were killed. But back then, it was absolutely horrible. He openly began training Jews to use weapons after the 1920 revolt. In 1921, he was arrested and spent time in a British jail, as was Husseini. They were both released. Ben-Gurion and he hated each other's guts. They hated each other's guts. Because wherever Ben-Gurion went and said something, he was sure to follow with a no. He was sure to follow with a no. Ben-Gurion hated him so much that in 1949, after the war was over, the predecessor to the Likud party, Begin's group, the, what was their first name? Wasn't the General Zionist. It wasn't Likud, it was the predecessor. I'm just drawing a blank right now. The predecessor, they said, we want to bring Jabotinsky's body back over to here to Israel, to bury him in Israel with dignity and honor. Ben-Gurion said, absolutely not. Ben-Gurion leaves office in 1963. In 1964, Levi Eshkol, the prime minister, says, sure, no problem, what do I care? So that's how much they absolutely hated each other. He was the guy who in World War I came up with the idea of the Jewish Legion. He was very into military matters. He was very impressed, by the way, he was so into military matters that he was very impressed by Mussolini. He wrote a lot about how great Mussolini was because Mussolini, you know, instilled order on the Italian people. He did it through military tactics. It was nice and orderly. That's what we Jews need to do. That's what we Jews need. In fact, he sent some people to train in Italy in a fascist camp at one point. And that's why Likud was always called fascist by Ben-Gurion and the others. He was part of the Zionist organization. He was good friends with Chaim Weizmann. They had a parting of ways. About 1924, 1925, he actually separated and formed his own Zionist organization. It was much smaller. He lost his influence. Eventually, with World War II coming, he went back into it. He died in 1940 of a heart attack while he was visiting a Beitar, his youth group, camp in upstate New York. He was only about 60 years old at that point. Actually, he was exactly 60 years old at that point. It would have been fascinating to see what would have happened if he lived another 15 or 20 years. His son was elected to the first parliament, but he had really no taste for politics. And so he left it after that. For sure, he would have been elected to parliament, to Knesset. For sure, and they probably would have been done even better. Let's take a look, because his ideology drives Likud today. This is where it comes from. So let's take a look at what he had to say about the Arabs. Any volunteers? It's just like my students at school. So I can't call your parents. All right. I consider it utterly impossible to eject the Arabs from Palestine. He's a realist. There will always be two nations in Palestine, which is good enough for me, provided the Jews become the majority. I'm prepared to take an oath binding ourselves and our descendants that we shall never do anything contrary to the principle of equal rights, and that we shall never try to eject anyone. The Likud movement believes in democracy. Menachem Begin could have caused a civil war in Israel during Palestine, what was called the season, during World War II, when the Haganah was hunting the revisionists for the British so that the British would help labor Zionists. Very complex relationships. There can be no voluntary agreement between ourselves and Palestine Arabs, not now nor in the prospective future. So he's saying, let's face it, for now we're going to be friends. I don't need to be friends. I'm going to be in charge. I'll protect your rights as a minority, but I'm in charge. So imagine, as our Arab files do, that's a slap at labor Zionists, that they, the Arabs, will voluntarily consent to the realization of Zionism in return for the moral and material conveniences which the Jewish colonist brings with him. Hey, you're giving them jobs, you're paving the roads, they're going to love you, is a childish notion, which has at bottom a kind of contempt for the Arab people. It means that they despise the Arab race, which they regard as a corrupt mob that can be bought and sold and are willing to give up their fatherland for a good railway system. You're a bunch of paternalistic snobs. That's what he's saying. The Zionists want only one thing, immigration. And this Jewish immigration is what the Arabs do not want. Colonization can have only one aim, and Palestine Arabs cannot accept this aim. This does not mean that there cannot be any agreement with the Palestine Arabs. What is impossible is a voluntary agreement. So I've got a great deal for you that you can't refuse. As long as the Arabs feel that there is at least hope of getting rid of us, they will refuse to give up this hope in return for either kind words or for bread and butter, because they are not a rabble, but a living people. It is only when there is no longer any hope of getting rid of us, because they can make no breach in the iron wall. Not till then will they drop their extremist leaders, whose watchword is never. You can see why this inspires people today. Some people. Right? You can see it. Now, he's an ideologue, he's an absolutist. You know, Ariel Sharon said something very interesting. In 2001, in September, he had a meeting with the editors of the Israeli newspapers. All the Israeli prime ministers do that just before Rosh Hashanah. It's always very candid, and they write very openly about it, because that's the Israeli media. And he said, you know, things look different from in here. So when you're in power, ideology seems to take a back seat. I wouldn't say a back seat. You manipulate it a little bit. But this is the ideology that drives Likud. It's the ideology that drives Likud. And he was a brilliant writer. He was a brilliant writer. All right. We talked about the Palmach. I just wanted you to see a neat picture about the Palmach. I love finding these pictures. I talked a little about the Cezanne. This is a watchtower where the Haganah uses a jail. Irgun, that's what it was. For the Irgun kidnappees. Now, what was the political party? The political party wasn't the Irgun. Oh, well. In the, after World War II, the Jews revolted against the British. It was their turn. So the Haganah and the Irgun came back together. This is the result of one of those things. Of course, one of the biggest things that happened was the King David Hotel being blown up.
Can I go back?
Absolutely. I'm running out of time. That's why I'm going quickly. Yeah.
See, Yabotinsky felt betrayed. He thought the movement would be the vanguard of Western influence crossing into the Middle East. And when the British came up with the first white paper and started to consider restriction of immigration, he felt they had betrayed and renounced the Balfour Declaration.
Yes.
And it became as much a war of tactics, where he made all kinds of accusations against Ben-Gurion. It wasn't that they viewed the situation so much differently in terms of the Arabs, but Ben-Gurion thought, we have to work with the British.
Yes.
We have to reach accommodations and incrementally improve our position. And as you said, you have no compromise,
right.
No consideration of the consequences. Masada, you know, we'll
right.
be martyrs
right.
because we're not
well
going to compromise our ideology. And that was the source. And
I think that's well put. Because they say, if you compromise on your ideology, you lose everything. You lose your whole reason for being. And Ben-Gurion said, no, I'm going to do what it takes to get a Jewish state, because that's the most important thing. And by the way, Ben-Gurion and the Jewish Agency pushed for a Jewish state in 1937 when the British offered them something. And any historian worth his or her salt will tell you today, and that was a sliver of land on the coast, basically, and going up to the north. Had that been open then, how many more Jewish lives would have been saved if you would have made that compromise? And then what would have happened would have happened. But you're right. That's exactly the tensions. All right, so, famously, yeah.
Was it the Heirut party?
Heirut, thank you. Heirut, which means liberation or freedom. Woo, thank you so much. Were you looking at last year's notes?
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome. Begin's group blew up the hotel. But this was a time when they were cooperating with the Haganah. This mission had been cleared with the Haganah Central Command. Begin said in his book that we called three times and the operator either didn't put us through or didn't take us seriously. After it happened, Ben-Gurion said, and all the death and destruction, said, we cut all ties with you, we denounce you, we're going to help the British get you. We had nothing to do with this. More enmity between Herut, Irgun, and Labor, Zionists. A bloody, bloody day in Palestine, and the British then cracked down on the Jews even more so. All right. World War II had some legacies. Jews enlisted en masse in the British Army because, again, they could get fighting experience. And some clearly felt that it was noble to do, and others had come from Russia / the Soviet Union and wanted to defeat Russia and the Soviet Union. Haifa and Tel Aviv were bombed by the Italians. People were afraid there was going to be an invasion. When Rommel was coming across the desert, there was a plan called the Masada Plan, where the Haganah was going to evacuate most people to the north, and they ringed Mount Carmel with caves, and they were going to stay there and fight a war of attrition / guerrilla war against the German army. Never came to fruition, but they were planning for that. There's some neat stuff on that. A true fighting force emerges for the Jews because of World War II. They didn't know that 1948 was when the British were going to leave, but they were preparing for it. The issue for the Jewish community overcomes their civil war because of Menachem Begin, in large part. And there's a great new book that came out in the last year by Baltimore-raised Danny Gordis on Menachem Begin. American Zionists are going to become the most important diaspora group due to finances because Europe is devastated. European Jewry is gone. And what's still there is leaving. Tragically, due to the Holocaust, there's more sympathy for Zionism in the non-Jewish world and the Jewish world than ever before. The divisions are gone. We no longer have Jewish communists other than in the Soviet Union, Jewish socialists, Jewish anarchists, Jewish Bundists, Jewish autonomous, where we started this evening out almost 2 hours ago. That's gone. World War II forever changed Jewish history. We didn't really talk about Weizmann tonight. We mentioned him once. His leadership overall is surpassed by Ben-Gurion. In the 1930s, this really happened. Ben-Gurion takes over for Weizmann as chairman of the Jewish Agency. He's chairman. Ben-Gurion's been head of the Jewish Agency for Israel, but of the World Zionist Organization. This, by the way, it didn't say where it was, and I've never seen it, but there's a memorial. 137 people were killed in the bombings in World War II in Israel by the Italians, mainly in Haifa, some in Tel Aviv. What the Italians were doing was they were bombing the British oil refineries in Haifa, which would halt their Mediterranean fleet. All right. Any questions on that? All right. We are about to wrap up. What we're going to get to next week is David Ben-Gurion reading the Declaration of Independence in Independence Hall. Anyone been in Independence Hall? Real big room, huh? It's a little bigger than this room. I don't know how they all got in there. And without air conditioning in May in Israel, I can't imagine what it was like. So we have gone on a real journey. For those of you who are new with us, we just covered 40 hours. So you should feel good about that. So if you're confused or want a refresher, please reread some of the Shapiro stuff, the beginning of it. There's a lot of good stuff. Now we're going to start with, actually next week we're going to do a little review, but we're going to do a lot of new stuff as well. We're really going to start in 1947, even though we're supposed to start in 48, but November 47 is really it. Any questions until now that we haven't answered? Awesome. Thank you very, very much, everybody. Have a great week. Have a great week without a Jewish holiday.